Welcome back to another edition of the Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's me, Len Testa, and this is our show for the week of Schmurz Day, August 2nd, 2021. On the show today, news in listener questions, is this the end of Schmurz Day? And in our main segment, Jim tells us about how Disney got its private Caribbean island, Castaway Key, ready for its first guests. Let's get started by bringing in the man who often wonders what became of the people who asked him for directions. It's Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
This is not my fault. This is my mother, lovely woman, but there were five of us. So a few things got glossed over, left, right, how to tie shoes. My theory is with the shoe thing, my mother was figuring, you know, one or two of them will fall down in traffic. That thins the herd. But the left, right thing, I must not have been paying attention that day. So I apologize to all those people who are now wandering around the wilderness going, he said turn left, didn't he?
Have you ever seen the meme picture that is Kermit looking out a rain-swept window? That pairs really well with that thing. I wonder whatever happened to the people who like the directions to.
Yes.
The funny thing is that I was once talking to my mom, and she was joking. I'm 99% sure she was joking. Mm-hmm. But she said, you know, why is east always on the right of a compass? I'm like, oh, Carol, don't, wow. Don't go there. Please don't. Okay. Don't ever drive anywhere. Well, yeah, we took our license after that.
Okay, yeah. Okay. For the nautical folks out there, port is always on the left, all right?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can remember because they both have four letters.
No, on, that's so it exactly. So, yeah. You know, yeah. But again, you do the east-west thing, it falls apart.
God. All right, Jim, let's do a quick shout out to subscribers over at disneydish.bandcamp.com. Thanks to new subscribers Buck Zach, Matt K25, and Melinda Joe 0407, and longtime subscribers Alanya VT, Rapunzel R, and Chris Wilkins. Jim, these folks, known as the Seis Caballos, are the backing band for Jose, Donald, and Pancho when they tour as the Three Caballeros. They say that being on the road with them is like traveling with family. And now that sanctions related to the Montevideo Holiday Inn incident from '83 have finally been lifted, they're looking forward to playing Uruguay again real soon. True story.
Is this where we bring up bird flu? Or no, never mind. Okay.
It was that thing with Randy Rhoads and the television. Anyway.
There we go.
All right, Jim, let's do the news. Folks, the Disney-ish news is brought to you by Storybook Destinations, trusted travel partner of the Disney-ish podcast. For a worry-free travel experience every time, book online at storybookdestinations.com. Jim, the big news coming out of Walt Disney World Disneyland, of course, is that indoor masks are now required for both vaccinated and unvaccinated guests in both resorts. This follows advice from the CDC earlier in the week and from Orange County Mayor Jerry Demings a couple of days ago. And that advice came because Florida is now second in the nation in daily cases per capita, up 161% in the last 2 weeks. Florida is also tied in for first in the country in hospitalizations per capita, up 126% in the last 2 weeks. Also, Florida's death rate is more than double the national average for COVID.
Yeah. So. You and I have been sort of watching this lurch over the horizon these past couple of months, and it's just sort of like, oh, please don't let that happen.
The thing is, you knew it would. Mm. Like, I've been running around Walt Disney World for the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think for six consecutive days, I spent 60 days in the parks, and I was talking to a Disney exec, mm-hmm. and I'm like, look, we're coming out of, I won't mention the ride because that would mm-hmm. identify the park, but I'm like, look, yep. Nobody inside this ride is wearing a mask. So either everyone's vaccinated, mm-hmm. right, including the kids who aren't eligible for vaccines, right? Tell me how that happens. Mm-hmm. Or people are just faking it, mm-hmm. right? People are just aren't following the rules. And you guys got to know this, right? You know this is happening. And so I'm a little disappointed there.
I am as well. And I think the thing that is so frustrating is that so many of us worked so hard to get to this point that we've done it. We've got the vaccine. You know, we waited the 3 weeks. We got the next vaccine. In fact, every day now when I go down to my local post office, has never removed the mask mandate. So, you know, literally every day, get out of the car, put on the mask, go in, get the mail, come in.
They don't deliver mail directly to you in New Hampshire? You're like the last frontier out there? What is it?
We live on a dirt road.
Oh, all right.
We are between two towns who, frankly, do you want to deliver a mail to him? No. Do you want it? No.
Okay, that's it. you literally live in an area disavowed by the postal
service. There we go. Neither rain nor sleet nor snow nor hail, but no, Jim Hill,
except,
no.
Except for that.
Except for that guy. No. You know.
So here's my question, Jim. You know how Disney recently changed its park opening procedures to go back to sort of what was pre-pandemic rope drop, where they would essentially hold people at places like the end of Main Street or the front part of Future World or the ends of Hollywood Boulevard / Sunset Boulevard, right? In groups clumped together outdoors and then, you know, release everyone like at official park opening or 30 minutes in advance, whatever. Do you think they're going to go back to what had happened during the pandemic where they opened the parks even earlier to avoid the clumping together of guests?
In theory, that makes sense. But remember, we are still in a staffing situation. They are still trying to get bodies to properly staff these parks. Please do not take this out on the cast members. This is not their fault. This is a very fluid situation where I bet you that stuff that Len and I are talking about today will have changed by the time this podcast is posted.
By Monday. Yeah.
And this is not their fault. I realize you're on vacation. I realize you paid a lot of money to get there. I realize you got up early and got in line and that sort of thing. But again, not the cast member's fault. And just, you got to roll with the punches here. You got to bring a little extra patience. The one little shiny light here that's worth noting is the number of people who've actually gotten vaccinated over the past week to 10 days. Thankfully, the Delta and the Lambda variant has put the fear of God into a lot of people. And so...
Oh, we're up to a Lambda variant? Are we really?
Yeah.
Jim, who knew that this is how we are all going to learn the Greek alphabet?
There we go.
By the way, you mentioned staffing shortages. I was talking to an unnamed person from an unnamed restaurant, either in Orlando or Anaheim, who said that they're losing more than $100,000 a day in business because they don't have the staff to operate the entire restaurant.
Oof. Wow.
Think about that. $700,000 a week in revenue.
Holy.
At least. It was actually higher than that, but I won't mention the number. Because they can't run the entire restaurant all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, how much more would you have to pay people to work there to keep it open? Like, it wouldn't be $100,000 a day. It probably wouldn't even be $1,000. Would it be $1,000 a day? So are the margins? I mean, I know the margins are pretty thin in restaurants, but are they that thin? Like, if you're Disney, right, and you know you're charging $52 for a steak, you charged $54 for the steak. So you know, little less than 2% increase. Mm-hmm. That's not enough to cover everyone? I don't know, man. I'd have to look at those numbers. By the way, let me tell you, I'll tell you off air what Disney charges this particular restaurant for rent.
Okay.
So, Jim, it's... Guess what they're paying a month in rent?
How north of $150,000 are we talking?
Oh, Jim. Jim. So I never want you to lose this childhood optimism that you have. So try closer to $700,000 a month.
Oh my God.
In rent, like, that's not rent. That's a shakedown.
Holy like, dude, cow. Wow.
Yeah. Good times.
Jeez. Holy cow. All right. Speaking of restaurants, you have some news about other ones that are they're opening up in property, right?
That's right. And so some of these are pretty good. So Pizzafari at Animal Kingdom reopens tomorrow or today, actually, August 2nd. Yay.
Okay.
Not my favorite place, but has excellent air conditioning and very good restrooms. So that's good. Yachtsman Steakhouse over at Yachts Club opens August 5th. Excellent cuts of steak. Our good friend Mike Scabetta used to be maitre d' over there, so shout out to Yachtsman. They have excellent service at Yachtsman. I really like it quite a bit. Toledo Tapas Steaks and Seafood. You can read the rest of the menu online. Also opens August 5th. I don't think Toledo's as good as Haleo for the same kind of food, but you don't have to go to Disney Springs if you're staying at Coronado, so I get that. And then other good news, Columbia Harbor House at the Magic Kingdom reopens August 5th. Columbia Harbor House is one of the highest rated counter service restaurants in all of Walt Disney World. So seeing that reopen is very, very good.
I agree. I just...
Wait, where's that outdoor line for Peter Pan going to go now? I mean, it's true. If they go back to physical distancing on some of these lines because of the mask thing, this is all up in the air. And the thing to me is, like, the next 30 days, the questions that everyone asks, the answers are all going to be, we don't know. Because it's going to take, even if everyone started wearing masks tomorrow, it's going to take 30 days for us to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jim, not for nothing, dude, but October 1st is 2 months away. You know, so it's like, we need to get this act together very, very quickly.
Especially when you think about, when did they start the ad buys for the 50th anniversary?
Yeah, I know. This is just not, it's not. And so just to sort of like put a number on this, the announcement came out yesterday evening. Between the announcement coming out and this morning when we're recording the shows, we had $100,000 in trip cancellations for touring plans, travel agency. $100,000 in like 12 hours. Oof. Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's so, crazy.
Not great.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So you got to think Disney, I mean, is many multiples of that. And they just got to be like, what do we do here? And it's really out of their control, right? It's up to the individual states. And yeah.
No. And that's it exactly. And, yeah. and certainly Florida, again, we don't need to get in the political end of this stuff, but, you know, Florida's response to COVID since the get-go has been interesting, and lots of agendas being serviced here, and especially with a state that has so much of its income tied up in tourism.
It's just
one of these things where it's like, okay, at this point, you really have to bite the bullet. You really have to do something because we can't keep repeating this pattern.
Yeah, we can't go through another year of this. This is not, it's not going to be great. So
no.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jim, let's do some listener questions. First one up from Sherry, who says, we recently moved to Orlando and want to know about the logistics of visiting the recently announced gingerbread houses for the holidays. I read that some hotels will be bringing these back, but my understanding is that you still can't just go to a hotel to visit unless you've got a restaurant reservation. Do I have to go through the hubbub of parking at Disney Springs, taking a bus to the hotel and back, or is there another way? All right, so it looks like the houses that they've announced, the gingerbread houses, the Grand Floridian, which always has, you know, a pretty big display, Wilderness Lodge, Contemporary, Boardwalk, and Beach Club, right? So you've got a couple of options there. For the Magic Kingdom resorts, you can park or get dropped off at the TTC and take the resort monorail all the way around. And then maybe a boat either from the Magic Kingdom to the Wilderness Lodge or, you know, something like that. For the Epcot resorts, you can get dropped off at the Swan or Dolphin, or you can park in their lots. There's a little bit of cost if you park, but it's better than trying to convince someone at Beach Club or Boardwalk that you can park. By the way, Jim, did you know that the Grand Floridian, even right now, has amazing chocolate animal displays going on?
Right now?
Right now. So if you, I've been walking around the parks and stuff. And you know where the Alice in Wonderland themed water play area is for kids?
Yeah,
at the Grand Floridian,
yeah.
Right sort of at the side.
Yeah, right off the lobby there.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you go through that lobby entrance, there's a display of a Florida, it's either panther or leopard. I'm not good on my zoology. In a plastic case there. But if you look closely, the sign on the case says it's made entirely of chocolate. And I looked at that, and I passed that thing 10 times over the last week until Laurel finally looked at it, and we were like debating, is it a leopard, is it a panther? And Florida looked at it, Laurel looked at it and said, it's neither, it's chocolate. And I was like, that is amazing. I mean, just the stuff that the pastry people are doing over at Grand Floridian is just astounding, just amazing. I mean, just works of art, really, really good stuff. So if you've got a chance to walk around the Grand Floridian lobby, take a look at those especially because they're really, really spectacular in addition to the gingerbread houses.
And please don't kick out the plug.
Please do not do that.
There's got to be some level of refrigeration involved here because it's like it's going to go from a Florida panther to a Florida puddle in one afternoon.
Exactly. There's some sort of Florida swamp creature. Everything with it, you know, speaking of the Alice in Wonderland pool, kids pool play area over at Grand Floridian. Have you seen how much water that big giant bucket dumps onto children? Like, you've got to be like 10 or 12 years old to withstand that. Like, I'm thinking it's taken 3 years old and just washing them out to, you know, out of the pool. It's an amazing amount of, like, Laurel and I looked at that and said, You know, kids be damned. I want to go play in this thing. Like let them come and try and kick me out, I think was what Laurel's exact phrase was.
As an adult, you have an appreciation for how much your neck vertebrae can be compressed by that much water hitting you.
Like, you got your chiropractor on speed dial as you're doing that.
Yeah, just it might be something to appreciate from a distance, Len. I'm just saying, okay?
Speaking of that, I was at, Polynesian on opening night back on the 19th. Mm-hmm. With Chrissy, and I hadn't been in the Poly main pool probably in 5 years. But you know, Gigi, my niece, was there, and Gigi wanted to go down the slide. So I don't know how middle aged men go down slides without ending up at the doctor's office. But there's a waterfall that comes off sort of the volcano part of the main Polynesian pool. Have you ever stood underneath that? That's a lot of water, Jim. I got to tell you, man, I was walking around the parks all day. And getting in that pool was the most refreshing thing I'd done in a long, long, long time.
If we're talking about therapeutic pools at the Disney resorts, I have to say, Stormalong Bay with it's a combination. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The sandy bottom and just that slight current.
I was telling Laurel exactly that. We were walking back from Epcot. I parked at Beach Club. And Laurel's like, hey, we haven't been to Yacht Club. Let's go to Yacht Club. So we walked through. And, walk past Stormalong Bay and everything. I'm like, this is a great, and you forget how big and how good the pool is until you're right there. But so we're actually like, oh, we need to stay at Yacht Club now. So that's where our next stay is going to be at Yacht Club.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll take the fold away bed. You guys are fine. I'll be out in the pool.
Laurel's idea was that the Ace Hotel Company should take over Yacht Club and turn it into another kind of hotel. Anyway. If you're a fan of Ace or McMenamins in the Pacific Northwest, same idea. All right. Here's a letter from Scott. He says, I'm from Scotland and have booked a 2-week vacation for the middle 2 weeks in October 2022. It'll be me, my wife, and three boys, ages 10, 7, and 4. My parents are also tagging along. And this sort of, Jim, this is a what if scenario. So let's go through that. For the first week, we have two garden rooms at the Contemporary. In the second week, it's a 3-bedroom condo at Diamond Resorts Grand Villas. We've been here many times, and the rooms are excellent. So, Jim, for reference, actually just checked out this Diamond Resort last week. It's right off of Palm Parkway, so sort of nearish Disney Springs. 3-bedroom villas, we measured it over 1,800 square feet. Big roof.
Okay.
So, are the benefits staying not only on property, but a deluxe now worthwhile since Disney started trimming back the benefits? The loss of free dining was bad enough, but Magical Express and rumors of paid fast passes is making me seriously look at doing just 2 weeks off-site. Would save around $4,100 by staying off-site. So the question from Scott is, should we do it? $4,100, Jim, staying off-site. So let's go over what the hassles are. You'd have to either rent a car or Uber back and forth, right? So there's a cost there of somewhere around, let's say, if you're Ubering $100 a day, if you're renting a car, $50 a day, plus parking, so $75, right? And let's say, for the sake of argument, that Disney does do paid fast passes and that they're going to cost $20 each. So for a family, or let's make the math easy, $25 each. No, let's say 20 because it's a family of five. So $100 per ride per fast pass. And you're going to do five of them in a day, right? So $500 a day in fast passes. You'd still only spend $3,500 a week in fast passes and you'd save $4,100. And you get 1,800 square feet versus like 900 square feet.
Yeah. This is what concerns me about the new math.
Right. Yeah. People start asking these exact questions, right?
Yeah. How many people is he bringing? He's bringing his mother-in-law. How many kids?
So total of his family, Scott's family's five, and then the parents are tagging along, but that's a separate set of accommodations.
All right. Take, for example, the Discovery Cove package over at SeaWorld.
Yeah.
For $200-some-odd, you get a day at Discovery Cove, but you get a full week of admission to SeaWorld and Busch Gardens. And face it, if you're staying off-site at the Diamond Resort Grande Villas, most likely you have a rental car. And this is what I worry about with Disney these days. It's just when the tipping point arrives, and I worry that we're getting closer to it each day.
I mean, for some things, we may be past the tipping point, right?
Yeah. And
because I'll be honest, Scott sent this email, but this is one of several that I got along the exact same lines.
Yeah. And this is the 50th anniversary year where people who haven't been to Disney World in a while will come back. And, you know, you don't want this to be the conversation they bring home. They got Fastpass, or, you know, it's this much to park, it's this much to eat. When you have a good time, you tell three people. When you have a bad time, you tell seven.
Right. So for $4,100, by the way, let me point out that there are other Diamond Resorts available. The one that I stayed at was the Grand Beach, mm-hmm. which was a two-bedroom. But it was also $100 cheaper than this. So, you know, for somewhere between $4,000 and $5,000 of savings, would you stay on site? And for reference, that's like a third of Scott's overall budget. Mm-hmm. I ran this idea by Laurel, and Laurel said she would pick the Contemporary because she likes being in the bubble, and, you know, you mm-hmm. don't have to worry about going back and forth, yada yada. Which I get, right? That's perfectly valid. $5,000.
And also, remember, you're talking $5,000 in a year where, you know, Universal down the street just opened VelociCoaster, which you've sung the praises of.
And, yeah, VelociCoaster's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, and we're just a year out for Hagrid.
That's a great point, actually. So if you saved $5,000 on every vacation, by the time that Universal's third park opens, you've saved enough for another trip. This is the comparison that I do every year in the Disney Cruise Line book, mm-hmm. where Disney's cruise to Alaska is 40% more, 60% more than the cost of a Royal cruise. So it's like, mm-hmm. you could go to Alaska on Disney, or you could mm-hmm. go to Alaska on Royal and to the Caribbean on Royal for the same price. Like, what would you rather do? Right. So yeah, that's, there's a lot of people that are going to get really good with math and spreadsheets very, very soon. That's what I'm thinking.
This is true. And it's just sort of like, yeah, you get time with Mickey, but is that really worth, you know, $4,000 and $5,000?
If you're doing that once in a lifetime trip, I get that, you know, not going to be as cost sensitive, but you plan to go every 5 years, you know, let's say, if you've got a couple of kids and you want to do one special trip for each kid, you know, $5,000 at a pop. I mean, that's a lot of college tuition, man. That's a lot of money. It's in the value propositions can be different for everyone, but yeah, but if you guys have, if our listeners have questions like this, let's go through them. I love the what if scenarios.
There you go.
All right, here's another question. This one's from Alex. It says, hey, Jim and Len, I went to Disneyland last week and I came back with some insights I thought you'd be interested in. While virtual queues were mentally stressful, I found them to be really easy to book if you're on top of everything. We booked both Rise and Web Slingers on our first day for a group of six. What shocked me most was mobile ordering. We had an order at the Hungry Bear for lunch, by the way, the finest dining establishment in all of Disneyland. I will not be taking questions. Okay. Anyway. It took over an hour after our check-in to get our food, and that's with a couple of escalations. The frustration was palpable throughout the restaurant as this was happening to everyone. Most of our orders were fine, but this one went way beyond egregious. Was this more of a one-time issue, or do you think there's some sort of more structural problem around mobile ordering that Disney is facing? And then post-COVID, do you think that Disney will keep mobile ordering around? So, Jim, you and I talked about a similar situation last week on last week's show in Walt Disney World, where we couldn't order fast food in or near the Magic Kingdom without a 60 or 90 minute wait to get it. Yeah. And so I think the main issue here is staffing. In fact, I know some Disneyland restaurants are actually starting to cut their operating hours, and I think that's because they're shorthanded.
Mm-hmm. The weird part of the mobile ordering thing is because it is so instantaneous. In fact, it sort of acerbates the situation. It's like, look, I ordered. And the notion of, well, where is my food? Do you mean the thing you ordered 30 seconds ago? Oh,
it's like when I order a package from Amazon, I immediately go to USPS tracking, you know.
Yeah.
And
you have to remember that Hungry Bear, just 18 months ago, this was handling hundreds of customers per hour with no problem. Mm. It just, they cannot get the bodies at this point. And and the staff that is working there is, you know, the very thing that he talked about, you know, the escalations, the circling back on the cashier or, you know, talking with the staff. That steps up to like a level of aggravation, and that in turn helps, you know, more people say, you know, this isn't worth it, and they step away from the job, and now you have to retrain somebody else to do that job.
And while you're doing that, they're short-staffed, which causes more pressure. Right? It's a cycle, right?
Yeah. Mobius strip. So
I wonder how much of this. I mean, so Alex brings up a good pointer. I wonder how much of this is a side effect of adding technology to this problem and making the mobile ordering virtual. So imagine it was a physical line, right? Mm-hmm. Where Alex saw an hour wait to get food. He wouldn't go to Hungry Bear. He would go somewhere else with a shorter line, or he'd go to a cart or a kiosk or something, right? But with virtual lines, right, it's easier to see what restaurants are available, and it's easy to see the return window time. But it looks like mobile ordering, when it shows you the return window time, isn't showing you your actual time to wait. And so it's hard for guests to tell that a restaurant's overloaded and therefore go somewhere else, because there's no visual cue to tell you that. And it's not like Disney's going to tell you, like, hey, Alex, you know, I know this, you know, you can, we say this window is 30 minutes from now, but you know, in reality, it's an hour, right? No. So I don't know how that gets better.
It was just a couple of shows ago. I think we were talking about the self-regulating lines with social distancing for things like Big Thunder.
And this is an area where I think in the technology masks that, so people can't make those self-balancing decisions. That's super interesting. Anyway, this is one of those areas where it should be a case study for something somewhere.
I don't know, absolutely. But that coupled with the fact that by the time you've walked all the way back to the Hungry Bear's
not in the middle of the park, right?
No. And you know, the whole notion of you've mobile ordered, you've committed, you're hanging in that area.
Yeah, your credit card's been charged, dude.
Yeah.
I feel for you, Alex. I feel for you. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. I wonder how to fix that. Anyway, if anybody has any good ideas, send them in. Mm-hmm. All right, last listener question from Greg with 2 G's. He says, I must turn to you as the inventor of Schmurz Day for a ruling on when it will no longer be Schmurz Day. I know we're stuck in Schmurz Day until things return to normal, but 2019 normal will no longer return. Will it occur once the Disney Comeback Index hits a certain number? My company has taken a cautious approach since the pandemic hit the U.S., but even now they're planning to send people back into the offices come September. Oh, Greg, when you wrote that email earlier this week, we were all so young. Anyway, Greg finishes. This is an indication to me that we're approaching the practical end of Schmurz Day, even though it will be forever in our hearts. So, okay. Greg and I actually went back and forth in this in email. And on the one hand, at some point, we all are going to remember what day of the week it is. And, you know, Schmurz Day was started off as a joke about all time all blending together. So, you know, I'm cognizant of the fact that one day, for practical purposes, we're all going to know what day of the week it is. But then we were talking about how every community, like, you know, the Disney Dish listeners, right? Every community has its own lingo and its own folklore, right, Jim? That's what makes it a community.
True. Right?
Mm-hmm. And maybe Schmurz Day is just this thing that we do.
That could be nice.
I don't know, right? So on the one hand, you know, new listeners who come in, when I say it's Schmurz Day, they're going to be, what is Schmurz Day, right? Mm-hmm. And then they'll have to be explained. And you don't want there to be a huge barrier to entry to listening to the show. I don't want it to be filled with, you know, so many inside jokes that no one understands it. And it's hard to become a listener, right? So it's got to be accessible to everyone. On the other hand, you know, a couple of inside jokes, you know, where we all sort of wink at each other and say, it's Schmurz Day. Like, I'm good with that. So I don't know. I think we should ask the listeners.
Okay.
What do you guys think? Right. Schmurz Day or no Schmurz Day going forward? Let us know. Jim, we'll have to run a poll on Twitter. Let's do that.
There you go. We place our fate in your hands, folks.
We're going to place our fate in the hands of social media. What could possibly go wrong? All right, folks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we come back, Jim gives us the history of how Disney got ready for the opening of its first Caribbean island, Castaway Key. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
How can it be August already? Wasn't it June just like 5 minutes ago? You know what they say. Never too late to have a happy childhood. Me, I'm actually trying to have a healthier adulthood, which is why I've been trying to cut down on the amount of sugar and carbs that I eat, which can sometimes make breakfast a bit of a challenge. But thanks to the talented team at Magic Spoon, a healthy breakfast doesn't have to be bland or boring. Magic Spoon has all of the flavors that you loved as a kid, but without all of the bad stuff. I mean, listen to this. Magic Spoon is keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, and low-carb. It's only got 140 calories per serving. Plus, Magic Spoon has 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. How can you beat that? Better yet, you can build your own box or get a Magic Spoon variety pack with available flavors like cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, blueberry, and cinnamon. Oh, almost forgot. Magic Spoon is bringing back two super popular flavors, cookies and cream and maple waffle, permanently. When these flavors were first introduced for a limited time a while back, they sold out extremely quickly. So cookies and cream and maple waffle are now back on a permanent basis. If you'd like to get your day off to a healthy yet delicious start, go to magicspoon.com/DisneyDish today and be sure to use our promo code DisneyDish at checkout to save $5 off your order. Mind you, Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed by a 100% happiness guarantee, which means if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Again, if you'd like to get your day off to a delicious and guilt-free start, head on over to magicspoon.com/DisneyDish and use promo code DisneyDish to save $5 off your order. Thanks to Magic Spoon for sponsoring today's episode. Feeling a little stressed and anxious these days? Gee, I can't understand why. Maybe it's time you gave BetterHelp a try. BetterHelp isn't self-help, and it isn't a crisis line either. It is professional counseling, which allows you, from the safety, comfort, and convenience of your own home, to connect with licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, grief, family counseling, relationships, and anger. Anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, and you two can then start communicating in under 24 hours. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video and phone sessions. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. And speaking of available, this service is available to clients worldwide. In fact, so many people have begun using BetterHelp that they are now recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. So why not start living a happier life today? As a listener to this podcast, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/DisneyDish. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/DisneyDish.
So anyway, Jim, we're talking here about Castaway Cay. And the thing that brings this up is later on this week, Disney's going to do its first cruise since the pandemic out of the United States, right? So, and we're sending people on it. So we'll be able to report back on it. But yeah, so I believe the Dream, it's a four-night
Bahamian cruise. What's kind of interesting is because they're not stopping at Nassau, these folks are getting two stops at Castaway Cay.
A double dip at Castaway Cay. That's my it's what we tell people the ideal first Disney cruise is: 4 or 5 nights on the Dream or the Fantasy with a double dip at Castaway Cay. Exactly what you should do. So okay, all right. So people are going to get two chances at this island. Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's the Dream that's making this inaugural cruise. And it was 16 and a half months ago since the Dream last set sail. That was Friday, March 20th, and went for a 3-day sailing, which also included a stop at Castaway Cay.
Yep.
And there's a reason that you talk about this is your ideal introductory cruise.
Yeah. I think Castaway Cay is the best island for having fun in the Caribbean. Barbados is a close second, but yeah.
You know, if we jump back, say, 240 years, people had an entirely different idea of fun, Lynn.
Did it involve piracy and rum?
It did. It did. In fact, there is proof that piracy definitely happened in the vicinity of what, by the way, original name of this thing is Gorda Cay, not Castaway Cay. Okay. But we'll get to that in a moment. But yeah, back in the 1950s, 3 coins and a 72-pound silver ingot were found just offshore of Gorda Cay. And based on the markings that were found on this treasure, it's believed that it once belonged to Spain's King Philip IV and evidently was plundered in 1773 when the San Pedro, a Spanish galleon, was attacked and then sunk.
Does Spain still have a claim on that? Because 72 pounds of silver, I know silver is only a few bucks an ounce, but 72 pounds of silver is still not a decent chunk of money.
But you also have to remember this is the Bahamas, which sometimes has a rather relaxed attitude when it comes to property ownership and contraband. And in fact, that brings us to the next crucial set of dates, for Gorda Cay, and that's January of 1920 through December of 1933, when an entirely different group of, well, I don't want to say criminals, let's say entrepreneurs. This is when the United States has a prohibition on the production, importation, transportation, and sale of alcoholic beverages.
Right. Prohibition. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. So at this point, Gorda Cave becomes sort of a way station and a people with alcohol. And we're not talking individual bottles here, folks.
Yeah. We're not talking a fifth of whiskey here. We're talking about moving, as the kids say, moving weight.
Oh, yes. Case after case. It was the legal good stuff from Europe coupled with the rot gut that was being made by folks who maybe operated out of bathtubs, but it would arrive in the island under cover of darkness, and those looking to buy the wares would also arrive at Gorda Cay with wads of cash.
Because you're how far are you from Florida? You're a couple hours boat ride from Florida, right?
Oh, yes.
It's not like it's Czechoslovakia.
No. And the Bahamian government takes kind of a blind eye to the whole operation because there's a lot of money to be had.
I am shocked that there's rum running happening on this island. Sorry, yes, your alcohol. Oh, thank you.
There we go. Yeah, Rick's Beachside Cafe. Okay, so anyway, Prohibition ends December 5th, 1933. All of the bank failures that occurred in March of that same year. Yes, the stock market crashed in October of 1929, but a lot of dominoes had to fall before we finally got to the true dark, scary point in the Depression. And that's when the banks start failing in March of 33. And you can draw a straight line from the banks failing to enough with this prohibition crap. We need to put something happy back into people's world. So it's like, hey, you can buy some alcohol, or more to the point, you can go work at a bar, which you can have
jobs.
A job.
Jobs. Yeah. Oh, I never thought of it that way. That prohibition. I mean, there was always a strong pushback against prohibition, legal and otherwise, right? But a lot of people didn't like it. But I didn't realize that the government looked at it as like, okay, things aren't going great. People need something.
Yeah. December of 33, 21st Amendment gets ratified, which in effect repeals the 18th, which, you know, as far back January of 1919, barring the sale of alcohol. So
this is great. So so the government came to the conclusion that alcohol is the opiate of the masses. All right.
literally. Okay. You know.
All right. Let's go with that, Jim. Let's go with that.
Okay. Now, the problem is, of course, lifting prohibition puts a crimp in all of this after-hours bootlegging that's going out on Gorda Cay. So next 30 years or so, you know, this Thousand Acre Island gets quiet. It's still a popular spot for yachters to stop. They anchor offshore, take a dinghy in, spend a day lazing on the beach.
I'm guessing grouper smuggling, not exactly the same sort of lucrative. Want to buy a lobster? Yeah, just not the same. Not the same thing. Okay.
But on the other hand, is, you know, we get to the late 50s, early 60s, we now see the rise in popular of small light aircraft like Piper Cubs.
Yeah.
And we see a whirl of activity out in Gorda Cay.
So the U.S. government had some sort of Air Force station in the Bahamas. And the reason why I know this is that Laurel, my wife, was actually born in the Bahamas.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that about
her. Yeah. Okay. On Andros. I believe Andros is the island. Yeah. But her father flew a small plane like a Piper Cub between Florida and the Bahamas, like when he needed to go, you know, to and from work and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
I would be fascinated to talk with Laurel's dad about this gentleman, Alvin Tucker.
Okay.
He buys 150 acres on the island, and he's the one who
actually, the thing that is now Castaway Cay.
Yeah, and he's the one who actually clears the land for a 2,400-foot-long runway.
It's still there. I've run on it.
No, that's – I wanted to ask you about it because it's
– Still there.
Yeah. In fact, if you talk with the Imagineers who worked on the changing Gorda Key over to Castaway Key, there was serious discussion about, we should get this runway out of here. We should return the island to its natural state.
It's a nice pathway, though, between the two parts of the island. So it was like, we're going to destroy this and then repave half of it?
The pushback was, half of what makes the Caribbean is the fact that, you know, that you know, you have these lovable scoundrels. In fact, we celebrate them in a certain theme park ride, you know, and just sort of like, why would we, you know, attempt to clean up this thing that's been there?
That's part of history. Yeah.
There you go. Alan builds this 2,400-foot runway with the notion he's going to open the island up for tourism, expand beyond the yacht-based crowd. Unfortunately, another industry leaps up instead, drug smuggling. And Gordicky becomes a way station to fly drugs into Florida. Tucker tries to stop it, even gets Bahamian authorities involved, but eventually he begins to realize everybody's on the takedown here. So he actually sells the property to a third party who in turn sells it to another third property, a gentleman called Frank Barber. And at this point, tons of illegal substances are traveling to the U.S. daily through this island. Locals would talk about how they'd see as many as 6 planes a day land on Gordicky and then continue
probably
on.
Probably more than we're landing in Palm Beach at the time.
One of the reasons I'd love to talk with Laurel's dad about this is that the Drug Enforcement Administration, which Nixon sets up in July of 73, as part of their global all-out war on the drug menace. I mean, Gordicky, this is a lynch point. We need to do something. So in 1983, there's a bust on the island where they intercept a $100 million shipment land.
Of drugs in that little island.
On that little island.
The island isn't worth $100 million.
Well, that tells you a bit about what might have been in that Piper Cub, Len.
It's $275 million in today's money, by the way.
Yeah, that's crazy.
We understand now why weed is legal in the United States. Wow. $100 million in 1983. Okay, so Frank Barber's involved in this, or it just happens?
And Frank goes to jail.
Wait, does he go to like a white-collar jail where he's like, does he go to, and I'm air quoting here, does he go to jail?
Well, I think in this case, you know, he went to capital J jail. They were looking to make an example. The Bahamian authorities, because of this high profile thing, immediately pivot to the fact, okay, we have to do something, but more to the point, we have to also do something that's fairly lucrative because, you know, this has been supporting the local economy. And somebody comes up with the, I'm not going to say exactly brilliant idea, given how stop and start film production is, but it's like, why don't we sell Gordicky as a location for movie studios and television shows to come and shoot?
Fair enough.
Okay. And so picture this one. It's the exact same year, 1983, that the $100 million bus goes down.
It's in the news. Okay.
And so who's the first company to step up to, again, the Bahamian authorities are mentioning this wonderful island that's beautiful. We should go there. The Walt Disney Company.
Of course. It's not like they were organ smuggling.
So if you go now and pull out your copy of Splash, the Tom Hanks, Daryl Hannah film, the scene where the grown-up Tom Hanks and the grown-up Daryl Hannah meet for the first time, this is the scene that has recently been redone for Disney Plus because the earlier version, that was shot in 83 and released to theaters in 84, you actually got to see a little bit of Daryl Hannah's rear end, and evidently that's a no-no on Disney Plus.
On Disney Plus, yeah.
Yeah, so 1,000-acre island, Disney only developed 55 acres, and they're trying to keep the guests confined to that chunk of the island. Now,
a large part of the island has never been developed. You can go up to the lookout tower, and I don't know if that was created by the government or the drug smugglers, you know, looking who was looking out for whom there. But there's a lookout tower, 3 stories tall, at the end of one of the runways, and you can go up there and see just exactly how much of the island is totally undeveloped.
Now, when you're up there, can you see, for example, they used a lot of the stuff that they pulled up out of the harbor to hide the sewage treatment plant and likewise the desalinization plant? Can you see any of that from up there?
No, you can't see any of it. No, not from there. And you can barely see it from the ship. Like you can see the buildings, but it's all really, really well hidden.
Okay. Well, I guess I should also mention that there is one other Disney film that has, in fact, shot at Castaway Key, and that is, of course, Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl.
God, what a great movie.
This is literally 20 years after Splash has been shot on the island, and Michael Eisner is fighting every day with Jerry Bruckheimer and Gore Verbinski over the cost of the Curse of the Black Pearl. And it's like, why does this cost so much? And so, you know, they're looking to do location work on an island, and Eisner's fine. Good, you want to shoot an island? We lease an island. You're going to Castaway Key. And they arranged to be there a day that there wasn't a ship there. And, you know, they shot it a bunch of scenes there on the beach with Keira Knightley and Johnny Depp, but that was at Michael Eisner's insistence to the effect of, you know, we've got to spend our money smarter.
Yeah, the funny thing to me is, like, if Eisner knew how big a success that movie would have been, would he have cared about $1 million here, $1 million there?
Talking with friends at the studio, they are still trying to figure out how to revive the franchise. I mean, don't get me wrong. We've got Jungle Cruise.
Comes out tomorrow. I'm super excited for it, yeah.
Yeah, but it's just the hope at the studio is this will turn into the next Pirates. Because frankly, they cannot break the back of the story issue of how do you do Pirates of the Caribbean without Johnny Depp. There isn't a film series there. Anyway, back to the Z Cruise Line. Cruise Line itself gets founded in May of 1995. Eisner wants right from the get-go for what Disney does with cruise lines to be different than whatever everyone else is doing at that time. So it's like, first of all, we don't want ships that look like giant milk cartons. We want ships that look like ships. Ours will be family friendly, so no casinos.
Two of the defining characteristics of Disney Cruise Line right there.
But the other thing that Disney's own research came back and it's like, well, all right. In a lot of ports, a cruise line cannot, in fact, come up to the dock.
Right, yeah.
That's it, exactly. So they have to...
They can't dock. They have to tender, yeah.
Yeah, so that it involves passengers getting on small boats, which are then ferried to the dock, and then you know, you're running them back and forth all day. And to be honest, this is a point where a lot of folks get injured or people misunderstand schedules and miss
it's
the boat.
It's a pain. Like, I've been on a couple of Disney Cruise Line cruises where the seas were so rough that we couldn't tender. And the reason is you've got a massive ship, like the Disney Cruise Line ship, and a really, really small boat, which bob in the ocean at vastly different rates, right? And you've got a plank that goes between them. And when the seas are moving up and down 5 and 6 feet at a time, it's like trying to ride a moving escalator that's not only moving up and down, but side to side. And it's very difficult to do it. So there are times when Disney cancels tenders. Like, we're just not going to this island. But I've actually been on detail cruises where it's been too rough to dock at Castaway Cay, and those are crazy days.
Really?
That's like tropical storm days. We're just going to camp out here today. All right, but that's rare. That's only happened like once.
Okay, so again, this tender issue really is a concern from a safety point of view, from an operational point of view, and we want to give folks something they can't get anywhere else. So it's like, well, what if Disney has its own private island? So they first look around the Caribbean, actually think about purchasing an island outright, can't find anything in their price range. So what they opt to do is they take a 99-year lease on Gorda Key. That's in 97, so the lease is up in 2096. So plan those vacations now, folks. Again, we've got that whole parked in the harbor, take a tender shore thing. Disney wants to avoid that, so they spent $25 million and spent 18 months, Lynn, to dredge a 1,700-foot-long channel that leads up to a dock facility of the island. They have to move 50,000 truckloads of sand and rock from the bottom of the Atlantic to create this 35-foot-deep channel, which, by the way, was constructed thinking that, you know, further down the line, we're going to make bigger ships. So to give Disney credit, they looked a little further down the line of like, all right, let's make this deeper than we have to. And we mentioned, of course, previously about developing only 55 acres of the island.
Yeah, I mean, like 5% of the island has been developed.
Yeah. There was a considerable amount of pushback about theming. First of all, do we just call it Disney Island? It's like, no, that's a little on the nose. There was an exploration of, okay, do we say lean into the Peter Pan mythology? And in the end, it's like, it's just sort of, you know, we're going to have families on board this thing. We're also going to have single couples, you know, we'll have adults. And so that's when they default to Castaway Cay.
Which is a good name. That worked out well. That's a good choice.
You've been there dozens of times at this point. So you know about the three different beaches, the ones for family, one for cabana guests, and then, of course, you know, the one strictly for adults. Yep. But that said, they still wanted some
Disney. You and I recorded a live show on the adult beach one time.
We did. in a high wind, I might add. They did want to try to put some Disney on the island. So again, 20,000 Leagues Ride closes the Magic Kingdom in September of 94. The 12 subs that make up the fleet of that attraction are parked outside in the Boneyard starting in 96. And at one point, they throw two of the subs on a barge and ship them out to Castaway Key and sink them in the snorkeling lagoon.
And they're still there. You can see them. It's one of the best parts of the snorkeling lagoon. By the way, the snorkeling lagoon is huge.
Mm-hmm.
If you paddle around that for a couple of hours, and they give you life preservers that you can blow up for buoyancy, so you don't have to swim the entire time. You swim there for a couple of hours, and it's an enclosed lagoon, so you're not getting super ocean waves or anything. But it's still exhausting. But it's
the cruise that you and I went on. The thing they don't tell you about snorkeling, particularly if you have a goatee like I do, you don't get a good seal. So I remember being at dinner that night to the effect of, I don't remember where I got black lung, but why can't I stop coughing? It's all the water I swallowed.
The thing I remember with that is, so I have a waterproof camera that I brought and did sort of 30 minutes of underwater snorkeling video. Mm-hmm. And the amount of colorful fish that you see is really astounding there, even given the fact that it's Disney and sort of they know what they're doing there. But yeah, I really like it quite a bit.
Yeah. Okay. So, but again, we get the two Disney subs. Isn't there a Disney or a Mickey Mariner statue sunk in there?
There's
as
a Mickey,
well?
There's a Minnie, there's a few other things there. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff to see snorkeling besides the fish too.
But for a time, that wasn't the only Disney item you could see at Castaway Key. Do you remember being there when they had the Flying Dutchman parked at the island?
No, it's right before I started going.
It was a wonderful photo opportunity, but it was also impossible for folks on the island to resist. The number of times they had to basically pull people off the Flying Dutchman because they'd swum out there. It just in the end, it's like, this is too big a liability. Yeah. And so they eventually one day just, raised the anchor, rolled the Flying Dutchman around to the other side of the island and dismantled it. Mm. I want to say that was back in November of 2010. Anyway, the island itself opens for business for the first time on July 30th, 1988. And we've seen periodic updates of it. We've seen, for example, 2009, we saw the Pelican Plunge Project.
Yep.
Likewise, in 2015, we saw the Summertime Freeze open. This is supposed to be rustic. This is supposed to be low key. We want things.
It is, and it is. It's there's no three story tower of serving ice cream or whatever. It's all very, very casual, very sort of go from hut to hut and see what's going on.
Which brings us now to what got announced in August of 2019, the Lighthouse Point project.
Yeah, and this is in conjunction with Disney adding three more ships to its fleet. The idea being that between the 3 and 4 night itineraries of the Dream, the 7 night itineraries of the Fantasy, and the various itineraries of the Magic and Wonder, basically that one berth at Castaway Key was spoken for virtually every day of the week.
Yep.
And there was going to be no way to add three more ships to that without cutting Castaway Key from some of the itineraries.
The problem of having the island in service day after day after day after day.
It's an isolated, they have to bring, some staff live there, right? But then they have to float.
They do.
There
were 140 people who, the height of the season, are on the island.
Yeah.
The wear and tear on the island itself is fairly astounding. So that was another reason why Lighthouse Point was put in the works. But also very, very different design aesthetic.
Yeah.
Castaway Key is going to be your rustic, fun location, where Lighthouse Point is going to be that much more sophisticated, a touch more modern.
And Lighthouse Point is actually connected to a larger island as well. It's a peninsula, right? Not the entire island.
This is true.
Island
this
itself. Is true. Whereas Castaway Key is a self-contained island that you've got a boat, everything back and forth to.
Lighthouse Point was announced in August of 2019, and as recently as March of this year, Bob Chapek was like, no, I know we've been dealing with some issues with the company, but that project's still definitely moving forward. They will be coming online 2023, 2025?
Something like that.
Okay. A month after the Lighthouse Point project was announced, Hurricane Dorian came through the area, and Disney actually dealt with some pretty negative publicity because they cleared more than half of the staff off of the island, but the 60 cast members stayed on the island with the notion of, after the storm clears, we're going to have to, repair the damage and get the place ready for the cruise line to come through. And It was one of these things where Disney got some heat about the effect of you put profits above people. And
yeah, I mean, have you been to Fort Jefferson in the Dry Tortugas off the coast of Key West in Florida?
I can't say that I have.
So it's run by the National Park Service. It was it was a fort built in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. By the U.S. government to prevent piracy in the Gulf of Mexico. We all know how well that went. Mm-hmm. But the National Park Service maintains a crew there to maintain the island, even during hurricanes. And they're like, yeah, you know, we have buildings and we sort of ride it out. And I didn't think at the time that that was any big deal.
No. And in fact, and let's be honest here, Hurricane Dorian, it only got within 40 miles of Castaway Key. And by then it had shifted into a tropical storm mode. Sure. I mean, still we're talking 73 mile an hour winds. But again, sometimes people complain about Disney just for the sheer joy of, you know, whether the biggest target. And in fact, Disney put profits above people, that's what they're saying in September of 2019. And then 7 months later, here comes the pandemic. In March of 2020, they shut down the entire cruise line for 16 plus months. And, so finally now, this coming week, we see them, head out, for this again, first cruise and head to Castaway Key. So,
yeah, I'm super excited to see what happens when it comes back. So, Jim, I know Castaway Key is like 100 miles north of Nassau. And Nassau itself is on a small island that is not sort of the big island of the Bahamas. But where's Lighthouse Point relative to Castaway Key in the ocean? Like, Nassau is between Castaway Key and Lighthouse Point, I thought. It's like 100 and some miles.
It is.
And it's farther east, isn't it?
Yeah. And in fact, I forget who I was talking with about, they're still eyeballing what's going to be the ideal travel pattern. The thinking is that we want a palate cleanser between Castaway Key and Lighthouse Point. We don't necessarily want to go sail from one straight to the other.
I think there are cruises that would do both. Oh, I guess there would be, wouldn't there?
No, there'd have to be. What Disney has found from its own survey work suggests. You are dealing now, I mean, face it, the first cruises went out in, 1998. And you've got 23 years of cruising. So, you've got people who took their kids on them, and those children have families of their own. And the nostalgia factor of, I want to take my kids to Castaway Key, in a weird sort of way, Castaway Key is going to be the Magic Kingdom to Lighthouse Point's Epcot. Yes, people want to go to the newer, sophisticated island, but they're still going to want to return to the thing they know and love from their childhood. So,
wow, that's super interesting.
So there you go. There's your history of Gorda Key, Castaway Key. Now, you've run the marathon on the island.
I've run the 5K on the island every time I go. Yeah, which is it's a lot of fun. Well, okay, so it's difficult because if you're on a longer cruise, you're basically sitting around and eating for 3 or 4 days. Mm-hmm. And then one morning you wake up and run 3 miles, which not really compatible with a buffet-based lifestyle, Jim. Mm-hmm. But the good thing about that is that traditionally, the people who are running the 5K are the first on the island each morning. So you get more island time, which is important. And you do get a medal, right, which is super cool. And, it's a good excuse to have that second buffet lunch because you worked up an appetite. The other interesting thing is because it's an island, and to your point, it's only 5 feet above sea level, right? There's a constant breeze going through the island. So you can run, and even if it's like 90 degrees outside, you don't really get hot until the end because of the breeze. You also go through a bunch of natural areas. It's all very pretty. You run along the runway. So like the runway is the first and last straightaway that you get. It's an out and back course. But you run around the observation tower that I mentioned. And so that's fun. And you can do biking on there. I know I mentioned the snorkeling. Mm-hmm. There's the adult private beach, which you and I have been on. That's great. Mm-hmm. I think the food's excellent on the island. I like the island quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I'm super interested to see what they do at Lighthouse Point because...
Same thing here.
On the one hand, you look at what like Royal Caribbean's doing with its multiple island stops in the Caribbean. And the idea is to build, more, bigger, better, right? On the other hand, that's not the philosophy of Castaway Key. And I think that's what a lot of us like about Castaway Key.
That's it, exactly. But at the same time, that's the fascinating part of the Lighthouse Point project. Yeah. The notion of this is the more rustic. So how do you do, Lighthouse Point, the more sophisticated?
Yeah. I wonder if it's going to be like a Wilderness Lodge for Wilderness thing where
Interesting point.
So when is Lighthouse Point? When is it open?
The problem is, of course, there was the opening date that was announced pre-pandemic, and then there's what we're dealing with now. So that's, again, the slippy slidey of, oh, did I say 2023? I meant 2025.
What even is time, yeah.
Bob Chapek, as early as March of this year, confirmed that, yes, it's still going forward. And keep that in mind for when we fire up the cruise line, which I'm going to be fascinated to hear what you're able to share from the folks you have on this first brand new cruise.
Yeah, we'll talk about it on next week's show.
Cool, cool.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for the Disney Dish show today. Please head on over to disneydish.bandcamp.com, where you'll find exclusive shows never before heard on iTunes, including an upcoming new show on the history of the flying saucers of Disneyland. On next week's show, it's the anniversary of the opening of Haunted Mansion at Disneyland, and Jim and I talk about the history of Disney's Haunted Mansions. You can find more of Jim at jimhillmedia.com and more of me, Len, at tutorialplans.com. We're produced fabulously by Aaron Adams, who will be judging the dog show at the 30th annual North Country Moose Festival on Friday, August 27th from 3 to 8 p.m. on Main Street in beautiful downtown Colebrook, New Hampshire. Jim, that's got to be near where you live, right?
That's right. At the end of the other dirt road where they can't get mail delivery. Oh, my God. What a coincidence. So,
while Aaron's doing that, please go on to iTunes and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We'll see you on the next show.